This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, I am really happy today to welcome to the program Jerry Padovano, who has written a book that is very inspiring and one that all of you should have a look at if you have the subject is cancer, and sometimes people get so nervous about talking about cancer. Even I find, you know, I say, oh, it's a word that you don't want to hear. But Jerry, you have done a wonderful job in writing a book that will help people. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you, Patsy. It's good to be here.
Okay. Well, the name of this book is The Ultimate Challenge: Surviving Cancer. Tell us your story, because it's difficult for me to ask, you know, how did it start? It's something that that C word that people say we don't want to hear, but it happens. And so people, when it happens in their families, they want to find something, some ideas on what to do. So tell us about your background, a little bit about your background too, and about your story.
Well, I am a former healthcare executive. I was an executive in healthcare for over 25 years. And my wife is a retired nurse. So we have a lot of experience in the healthcare industry. And I watched a lot of folks go through this terrible disease from afar and by the bedside. And then to be afflicted by it personally was quite a challenge. But I really believe that when you're afflicted with something like this, whether it's cancer or heart disease or diabetes, whatever it might be, any debilitating disease, you've got to find the positives in anything that you face. And that's what I tried to do during my ordeal. I was diagnosed in 1994 with colorectal cancer, stage 3. And my uncle on my father's side of the family was diagnosed with it about a decade earlier. My grandfather died of it in the 70s. So it is hereditary in my family. So we knew going into this that there was a risk involved that I would come up with this disease, and sure enough, I did. And I wondered, while I watched them go through it, how they dealt with it. And, you know, I learned a lot from them. And then I took it to the next level based on that knowledge. I wrote the book really primarily to provide support to those afflicted with cancer and any other debilitating disease. And I also wrote it for the caregivers, because a lot of people don't realize that caregivers go through a very difficult time when their spouse or their loved one is diagnosed and goes through something like this. So hopefully the book is reviewed by people who are both afflicted with the disease, who are trying to survive it, and also for the caregivers who are trying to provide that love and care that the patients need.
Okay, so in your case, as you said, you knew this was in your family.
Yes.
And now more and more people, you know, since we've been able to test and do all this DNA testing, people are now more aware of these diseases.
That's right. In fact, early detection is really the key. Colorectal cancer is the second largest and most common cancer and cause of death in the United States. That said, it's also the most preventable. And that's because if you do your screenings, if you do your tests on a regular basis, you can help catch this early and you'll be okay.
Now, having this knowledge that you had this disease in your family, you were more proactive than perhaps most people who don't have any idea that it's in their family.
That's correct.
In many cases, you know, in the olden days, which were, you know, people didn't really talk about it very much.
That's right. The C word, as they called it, was a death sentence.
Yes.
And nobody wanted to deal with that. But today, because of technology, because of communications, and because of the advances in medicine, this does not have to be a death sentence. And I'm here to talk about why I believe that early detection and just talking to people about this is a very healthy thing to do.
It is. It is. It's very, it's, you know, as I, even I, you know, I'm talking about it, but it's scary. I feel this fear because I do know a few people, not in my family, thank God so far, but, you know, we do know these people who have this running in their families. And I always thought, whoa, it's a scary thing to know.
It is. It's a very scary thing. It's a very unsettling thing. And one of the things about cancer that's very unnerving to people who are diagnosed is the fear of losing control of your life. You know, as a healthcare executive, I was used to being in control of my life. I had a lot of folks that reported to me. I had a huge responsibility in the healthcare industry. And then to be diagnosed with something that could kill me really threw a wrench in the works. And it became an issue of, you know, how do I not only survive this, but how do I maintain control of my life? And that's really the challenge for people who are afflicted with this.
Now, when it first happened to you, when you got the diagnosis, tell us a little bit from the personal side. What was it like for you?
Well, I was only 40 years old when I was diagnosed. And so even though it was hereditary for us, 40 is still quite a young age to be diagnosed with a stage 3 colorectal cancer diagnosis. And so it was a splash of cold water in my face. And to me, it was really a matter of just taking it in, beginning to realize that, well, first you go through the denial stage, you know, this can't be right. And then you go through the pity stage, you know, you feel sorry for yourself, you feel sorry for the people around you. And then you go through the acceptance phase. And then once I got to the point of accepting what the diagnosis was, I needed to then begin to understand how we got through it. And, you know, it's the fear of the unknown is a very powerful thing. So once you're diagnosed and you find out exactly what the plan is to get you through it, it gets a little better. Because then you're on the fight team, you know, and you're able to know what the goals are. So chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and all the rest were all part of my plan to get me through this. And then, of course, surgery, and then more chemotherapy. During the process, I lost about 65 pounds. I was pretty much skin and bones. But, you know, I would look in the mirror and I'd say, I can do this. I can still do this. My wife was a huge support of mine. She retired, you know, she took a leave of absence from work as a nurse, and she became my personal nurse, which fortunately for me, that was great. But a lot of people, you know, they don't have that luxury. They live alone or they don't have that kind of care. And this book was written really to help them understand that the way you feel is the way you feel. There's no right or wrong way to feel about cancer and the diagnosis of it. It's really about how you internally deal with it and how you can look for others for support, even if you don't have that immediate support in your family. There's a lot of support out there.
And because so much of it does depend on attitude.
It does.
You have to have a positive attitude.
You do. And thankfully, in my world, you know, I was always a person with a positive attitude, so it came naturally to me. I found humor in just about anything that happened to me. And so even when I was at my sickest, I was finding some humor in it. I'll give you one example. I was walking through the hospital one day with my wife in the hallway with my IV pole and my hospital gown. And one of the residents or nurses came up to me and said, is there anything I can do for you or your mother? He told my wife, is there anything I can do for you or your father? And I turned to him and I said, well, I happen to be her husband, and I'm also an executive at this hospital, so I would watch myself if I were you. Of course, I was kidding with him. Well, after that, he was by my bedside like every hour on the hour. I mean, he couldn't get enough of me, and I found that to be kind of funny. I played a joke on him, and it helped me get through that day,
yeah.
You know. And so it's just the little things like that that help you get through things, you know, and I find humor in just about anything.
So when... At what point did they say you're cured. Do they ever do that?
You're never really cured.
But you're just...
You're in remission. That's right.
And so this is 1994,
and so, I actually went through all the way to 2016, and then I had a recurrence. I had another colon cancer diagnosis. This time it was only a stage one, and so they had to go in and remove more of my colon, so I don't have much left. I do have a colostomy, which scares a lot of people, but frankly, the colostomy saved my life. And I'm able to function pretty normally, even with a colostomy. And a lot of people, when they hear about a colostomy, they think their lives are over as they know it. There's nothing further from the truth. You can live a normal life with a colostomy, and I'm living proof of that.
Well, that's why I wanted you to be on the program, because as you can see, I'm uncomfortable myself talking about this subject, but it is a subject that we need to know about. We had a friend who was in the same situation, and I think having him around, knowing that he would show up every week at synagogue. He would be active. He never gave up, and this was an inspiring event for everybody around him. And we need that. We need to know that, you lasted a long time and you're going to last another 20, 30 years. So it can happen, and particularly with the improvements that we have nowadays.
Absolutely.
It's really quite incredible, the difference between, I'm sure the type of chemotherapy you had in the old days was much rougher than what they've managed to they're doing now.
There are lots of different types of chemotherapy, and people react to the chemotherapy in their bodies very differently than others. So some people lose their hair, some don't, some get nauseous, some don't. And so I would advise people that are going to go through this to try to keep a positive attitude throughout and work very closely with your doctor and ask a lot of questions. That's really important. Physicians sometimes don't know the questions to ask. They're there to treat the disease, but a lot of times it's an emotional issue as well, and people need to understand that asking questions and being informed can really help you through the process. I did a lot of that, and I was fortunate to know my physicians who were working at the hospital that I worked at, and so I knew them very well, and I was very fortunate in that I trusted them without question, and I was blessed to have some of the best physicians around to get me through this. Obviously, your attitude is important, but having a good physician is also important.
Well, did you find, once this happened to you, that you changed your lifestyle? Did you, you didn't want to run off to an island or something and sip pina coladas?
Oh, sure, that's always appealing, even when you're well. But my view is that it did awaken me to certain things about life that have changed in my mind. I don't get as upset as I used to about the little things. You've heard the term, don't sweat the small stuff. Well, that's really true. Stress can be a very big proponent of getting sick, like cancer or heart disease or hypertension. So letting go of as much stress as you possibly can is a good thing. And so I learned that through this experience. And don't get me wrong, I'm human. I get upset. I get mad. But I temper it with realizing what the big picture is. And that is, you got to offload that stress in order to survive in this world. And that's what I try to do every day.
Because you had a stressful job, isn't it?
I did. I had a $1 billion budget. We had 50,000 employees at our organization. It was quite a stressful position, but it was a position I enjoyed and relished. Then I would travel from Florida to California on a regular basis, and that added to the stress. In 2013, I had a stroke, and so I was actually forced in 2014 to take an early retirement at 60. And I think from the stroke and the two battles with cancer, my view of life is very different than many people's view of life, which is every day is a blessing. Get up every day, seize the day, and make the most of that day, because you don't know what tomorrow brings.
And I was very pleased that you brought in here a poem that you turned into a bookmark. And you know, since I did have Juan Felipe Herrera, the poet laureate of the United States, on the program, it's nice that today Jerry is going to read his poem, right?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. And it's, you know, again, it's something that I wrote. And let me say, first of all, Patsy, that the inspiration to write the book was primarily driven by two things. One is I needed to release what was inside of me because, you know, even though I was going through this, I needed a release. I kept a log of how I felt every day, which is something I think most people should do when they're going through something like this. It helps to get that release out. You know, you bottle it up inside, not healthy. So I went ahead and I created this diary or log every day. When I took a medication, I would write down how I felt about the medication, how I reacted to it, my diet, the pains I was feeling, the experiences with chemotherapy and radiation therapy. All that was documented. And I did that to keep busy and to also express and get it out of my system. Then I realized that this information would be helpful to other people. And so the book was born. I used a lot of my notes to bring this book to life. And again, with the express purpose of helping people, caregivers and patients alike. I'm so happy I got to write it because I feel like I'm giving back through the second and now third chance I've had at life. And so when I get letters from people, even to today, even though the book is 10 years old, I get letters from people all around the world who say, thank you for this. It's helped me understand the emotional roller coaster you go through with this, but there's a light at the end of the tunnel. It doesn't have to be a death sentence. And so this book is not a clinical book. It's really a book about how to deal with adversity and how to find humor in that adversity. So with that said, I'll read you my poem
okay.
if you'd like.
I do.
All right. And it's called Make Today Your Day. And here it goes. I know it's not easy, and it just doesn't seem fair, but I hope that you realize there are people who care. So break away from the stress and do something you like. Go and visit with family, or just ride a bike. A stroll in the park, a walk on the beach, a trip to the mall, they are all within reach. Just put your mind to it, I know that you can. Grab a pole and go fishing, or just hold someone's hand. Make each day your day and do something for you and live life to the fullest because it's the best thing to do.
Oh, that is beautiful. It is a wonderful poem. Are you writing more poetry?
Well, you know, this was my first attempt at writing. I always excelled in school in English and literature, and I love reading and I love writing. So I have another book in me somewhere. The choice is, what do I write about? Obviously, I've had the stroke and I've had a second bout with cancer, but I think I've kind of beaten that horse to death. So I'm looking at other things, possibly about retirement and how to deal with the retirement issues that you face. You know, as a healthcare executive, I was busy 24/7. My phone rang constantly. I had, you know, 1,000 emails a day. And then when I retired, it was crickets. There was nothing. And so that's kind of a shell shock thing when people go through that. So I might do something about that at some point.
And there might be a novel in you, too.
You never know.
You never know because...
living in Clearwater, in this area, I live in Bel Air Bluffs, of course. And, you know, it's a very inspirational place to live. You know, you sit out there each night, you watch the beautiful sunsets. And by the way, I took up photography when I retired, so I take a lot of sunset photos and photos of wildlife. And so that's another thing that I got going for me that I really enjoy doing in my retirement. Plus, being a doting grandfather, I have a 13-year-old and an 8-year-old, two grandchildren, one girl, one boy. And of course, my wife of 45 years, and I have two sons who I'm very proud of. And so the family and my photography and the sunsets and living in this beautiful area are an inspiration to write. They really are. And so I've got something else in me, I'm sure. I just need to figure it out.
And we have a lot of wonderful writing groups here to work with. And it is always fun to get together with writers. And you are inspired to do that page a day.
Absolutely.
You know, once you start, once you get an idea. And it's great that you're doing a lot of different things. And it's, you know, writing is such a wonderful way to help people and to just keep your mind going. So why I do this program is to encourage writers. And for any of you out there, you know, something has happened to you in your life that you think, you know, you have it in the back of your mind. You say, oh, I should write it. I should get it on paper. Well, just do it. I mean, sit down one day and start. Isn't it funny how once you start writing, it is something that it just gets more, you get a pleasure out of seeing your words on paper.
Without a doubt. In fact, when I got the book first draft from the editor, and I got to see my picture on the cover and the whole package, it's a feeling that can't be described for a first-time writer. It's just such an awesome feeling. And then to know that that book would be out there helping other people was even more of a rush for me. And like I said, even 10 years later, I'm still getting people that recognize the book, read it, and contact me about how it affected them. And there's nothing better, no better feeling than helping someone else.
Well, I think you've done a beautiful job with this book. I have a feeling that, well, you know, when I was reading, I thought, well, you know, this is very nicely written, and he's got talent and a way with words, and I have a feeling there's another book in you. So, you know, it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing that you've done for people. The name of the book is The Ultimate Challenge: Surviving Cancer, and where can people get it?
You can get it at any online bookstore. Amazon certainly has it. You can also go to my website at www.jerrypadovano.com, and you'll be able to purchase the book through the website as well. And you'll get to see some of the reviews that are out there for my book, as well as some of the backstory of my life. And so that's another avenue for people if they want to look into the book. But certainly Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the rest are out there, and you can purchase it through them, both on the hardcover and paperback.
Well, because I saw the name and I love the name. What is the background of the name? Because
I'm Italian-American, my family comes from Naples, Italy. And, of course, one of my grandparents came from Sicily. So I have a mixture of both in me, and I'm very proud of my Italian heritage. And that's actually helped me to get through life as well. So, yes, that's my background, and a lot of A's in the word. So, you know, Vanna White would have a ball with that.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I'd like a vowel, please.
Yes.
Padovano.
Padovano. Yes. It's a great name. I'm always looking for new names, you know, that you don't see in novels, and I thought that's a cool name. That's
Thank
really
you.
Nice.
Well, before we go, I'd like to also commend you, Patsy, for doing this. I think that you provide writers like me and people who want to be writers an avenue and an opportunity to get their word out and to encourage them to do that. Because in my view, this kind of a thing, writing a book or attempting to write a book, is a very noble thing to do. Because if it can help other people in some way, then you've done a good thing. And so you providing that avenue for people is really great. So I want to thank you for that.
Thank you for the nice words. Because that when I started this program 4 years ago, I just celebrated the fourth anniversary. I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do, but I did know that I wanted to encourage people to write.
Yep.
and to help people. And so I feel the same way, that it might be just a paragraph in a book that they read, but it can change their life.
Everyone has a story in them.
Yes.
Everyone.
Everyone.
And it's just a matter of, do you want to get that story out or not? But everyone's got a story to tell. And certainly I'm not the only one out there who's had issues and problems. There are millions of people who have them. And they all have their own story. And so I would, like you, encourage people to sit down and think about what you want to write and go for it.
Go for it. Well, you did. And it's Jerry Padovano. And the name of the book is The Ultimate Challenge: Surviving Cancer. And you can get it wherever books are sold. And Jerry, I want to thank you so much for joining me today on Joy on Paper. It's been a joy to talk to you and a joy to see the joy that you have in life, that you have found and that you're sharing with people.
Thank you, Patsy. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye now. We're going to take a commercial break and then we'll be right back.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com. From the author of gut-wrenching novels Guns Up and Gunner's Glory, now a gut-wrenching comedy, Section 8. One fan writes, Section 8 is inspired insanity. Johnny Clark should receive the Pulitzer Prize and his commitment papers in the same ceremony. You will laugh till it hurts. Section 8. It's 1946, and President Harry Truman has two goals in life. Dump the U.S. Marine Corps and get reelected. Can he convince Congress that the Marine Corps is obsolete? He'll try, but first he wants to use them one last time. There's something he needs them to do. A little mission to China to steal something that one of his contributors need. It's dangerous, but who cares? Marines are expendable, or so he thinks. What could possibly go wrong? A lawsuit by the Vatican? An attempted assassination by a dead assassin? Flamethrower sermons? If that's not enough, there's a missing A-bomb. This book has it all. Even a love story. Remember, Section 8 is only a temporary state. You hope. Written by a true American hero. You'll love this book. Now available on Amazon. So get it today. Section 8 by Johnny Clark. Semper Fi.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
With a Z, and in a few minutes, I'm going to be talking to Irene Goodman, a literary agent from New York. She's going to be calling in. But meanwhile, I did want to also add to everybody, I had mentioned before a program that really is wonderful for all of you people who are writing complex books or books that have like a memoir where you have a lot of different information. Scriptr is just a wonderful program, and it's $29, so it's a wonderful thing. Okay, well, I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Irene Goodman. Hi, Irene.
Well, hello, Patsy. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, well, it wouldn't be a fourth anniversary without you, I can tell you, that's
Thank
for
you.
Sure. Wow. How are you?
I am great, thanks.
Well,
how are you?
You know, it's I saw that you were cold up there, and we had to turn the AC on yesterday. So it's
I know. I don't want to hear that. I want to hear
I
it's
know.
Too cold here.
I know.
It's too cold. It's April. I feel like time's up. That's it. It's got to warm up.
Where are the tulips, right?
Yeah, it's too, yeah,
exactly. Well, you know, I went to visit my son up in Wisconsin in Madison a few weeks ago, and it was negative 17.
Oh, God.
It was such a shock to my system. It was, you know, that's colder than my freezer. And
really?
Negative. I mean, that's cold. And there was so much snow. It was unbelievable. And it's the first time I've seen snow in 25 years.
Really?
Yes, because, you know, we lived in Texas. We lived in Florida. And the last time I went, I went skiing and I saw snow. So it's that long.
Wow.
But I don't miss it. I don't miss it, really. I don't. Wow.
I like it in the beginning. And then it's
Yeah. Well, we're Michiganders, so we've seen enough snow, I think.
Oh, I remember that. I remember walking to the bus to go to high school and climbing over mountains of snow. Yeah. Oh,
wow. Now, when you arrived in New York, were you did you already have a job?
No.
No?
You no. Just, I did not. Well, at first I moved to Boston after college, and I had a job there for 2 years. And then I decided I wanted to go into book publishing. And I learned that there were only two publishers in Boston, both quite distinguished, but only two. And Boston is a town filled with young people right out of school looking for the same three jobs. So it was virtually impossible to get any kind of real job there. So I realized, okay, got to move to New York. So I did, and I moved in with my cousin, who was a musician, up all night playing the oboe, and she had an apartment on West 110th Street. And I moved in, and I had a job in about 3 weeks as an editorial assistant, and that was it. I took it from there. I wanted to do something that had to do with books. So in Boston, I worked at a library for a while, but that was boring. I realized, well, I don't want to do that forever, so I just kind of figured it out, and I realized, well, I have to be in New York if I'm going to do this. So I drove to New York from Boston, and here I am, still here.
And, of course, yeah. You have a wonderful agency, so well-known, the Irene Goodman. I mean, you named it after yourself, after all. Irene Goodman, literary agent.
Well, in those days, that's what everybody did. If I were starting an agency today, I would not call it that. I would call it something else, something more clever. But that was the style then. You're talking 40 years ago. So yeah, that was the style. And so that's what everybody did.
And who was your first client?
My very first client was a very nice lady named Carol Norris. I was working for another agent, and she was his client, and she was writing historical romance. And that market was starting to boom around that time. And he really had no idea what to do with it. He was representing the likes of Stephen King and people like that. It was just not in his wheelhouse. So he gave it to me, and I started selling her books. And others came after that.
Wow. It's so exciting. I think of those days, 40 years ago in New York was a very exciting time. And I like the clothes that they wore. It's so different in those days.
I don't like that era at all in terms of how it looked. But yeah, New York was very different. New York had it had to be cleaned up a lot. Like the whole Times Square area was just awful. And it was Giuliani who cleaned it up, I have to say. And, you know, things always change. But it is still the vibrant, diverse, exciting, never know what's going to happen city that never sleeps. Exactly. That is still true.
Yeah, there is no place else like New York City. When all I have to do is say, oh, she's a New York City literary agent, it's like, everything like starts sparkling around you, you know. It still has that power.
Yeah, but yes, it does, and I feel that sometimes. But there's also the reality that I grew up in Michigan. I'm a Midwesterner by birth, and I chose to come here. I chose to enter this vibrant, crazy place, and that's really all you need to do. I mean, anybody can do it. You just have to pick up and come here. And the great thing about New York is you can be a New Yorker if you've been here for 2 minutes. There are other places where if you haven't been born there, forget it. I think there was in the movie Jaws, there's some line about that. No, you're not an Islander. If you weren't born here, forget it. You could never be an Islander. New York, anybody can be a New Yorker. You just have to be here.
And you have to be able to walk fast through all those people in the streets. It's still for people when they come to New York and they're not used to seeing so many people in one spot. There's this excitement, sort of a tingly excitement of seeing so many people just like all going across the street at the same time. It's still,
yeah, that's true.
It is. It's exciting.
That is true. Well, you can always tell out of towners because they look up. When you live here, you just want to get where you're going, so you don't look up at the buildings.
So you've been part of a very exciting time in the publishing industry. Things have changed over the years. Now, is it true, I've heard, and people say that now agents really have to do more because in the old days, the publishers did part of the work that you are now doing.
I think there's some truth to that. We do more editing than we used to because they don't do it. They'll just not buy it. Yeah, they used to work with things more editorially. So the bar has been raised. Also, there's so much more competition for people's leisure time. You could spend all night entertaining yourself with your phone. You don't need to read a book. You don't even need to watch television, although there are 500 channels you could choose from. So that's part of it. And, of course, the Internet has changed everything. But I don't think it has really changed what people read. They just might read it on a different format. And there are still plenty of readers left in the world. It's just that there are more things to do now besides read.
Well, and I think people still love books. I was, when I went on that flight, you know, to Wisconsin, I was surprised as I'm walking down the aisle how many people actually had hardback books. Mm-hmm. The two people next to me, they both had hardback books. I walk down the aisle, I see, you know, every other row, people had hardback books, not paperback books even. And some people were reading on their Kindles and like, but I was surprised how many people had hardback books with them.
Well, the mass market paperback, a rack size mat, has almost disappeared. I mean, it used to be a booming market of its own, and now it's been really cut back because people who are willing to pay $8 for a paperback book can get it on a Kindle or, you know, a device and read it that way. Those are people who tend to read a lot, actually, and it's just more convenient for them to have it on a device. But hardcover is still very much around, obviously. Some people prefer that format.
Well, Lee Child, I heard that Lee Child is selling one hardback book every 6 seconds.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, like every 6 seconds. I mean, that's a lot of hardback books.
Yeah. Well, there's also original trade paper, which, for example, if you're reading something that's historical fiction or women's fiction, that might be the format you're reading. That is basically, it's a hardcover book, the size of a hardcover book, but with a paper cover. But it tends to look more upmarket than a mass market paperback. So, yeah, I mean, the formats are all still available.
From the agency point of view, again, how does it work now? Where does a publicist come into the deal? Through the agent? What's the dynamics on the roles that the three parts play?
Okay, I just want to make sure I heard you clearly.
Yeah.
Publicist.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there are two ways to have a publicist. One is the publisher will provide you with one. That person may or may not do much. If you're a very big author, then they will definitely kick in. They will do a lot. If you're not, then you're pretty much expected to do a lot of your own work. And basically that means making yourself into a presence. There's a lot of noise out there, and if you want to compete with all that noise, if you want to be noticed at all, you have to do something. So you're expected to have your own social media and to be growing it. And a lot of people hire someone to do that. It's really better if you do it yourself because people want that personal connection with the author. And you can certainly, many people will hire their own publicist to do more things for them that the publisher is not going to do. I think it's one of the biggest misconceptions that new authors have. They think, oh, the publisher will make me famous. No, it's actually the other way around. They would rather that you be famous because then you'll be a lot easier. It will be easier to sell your books. They cannot create something from nothing. You have to bring in something with you. You have to bring in a following, a readership, a fan club, a herd. People like to use that word, a herd of people. We had an author here once. I can't even remember her name. But she started a blog about the process of becoming an author and what she was going through and hoping and praying that she would sell her first book. And this blog got a lot of followers, a lot of attention. And she did sell her first book, and there was a herd in place, all those followers she had built up who went out to buy the book in its first week, which created velocity, which is something publishers very much like to see. So if you've got to get into the game a little bit in that regard. Some people say, well, I wrote a great book, isn't that enough? Well, you know, in a fair and sane world, it ought to be, and it used to be. But today, if everybody else is out there on social media and creating a presence for themselves, then where does that leave you if you don't do it?
Now,
I hope that answers your question.
Well, I have so many, you know, people who come in with their first novel and they go through that query letter. I'm not even going to get into that today because that's like a whole big program. But so they think that once they have an agent, especially if they have a New York City agent, how do you get them a deal? We still read about recently, Writer's Digest, who got a seven-figure deal? The name I can't remember right now, but somebody just got a seven-figure deal, which really sounds great, doesn't it? Is the agent very happy when you know, when you get a seven-figure deal? Are you like you're having a party?
If you get a seven-figure deal for a first book, then yes, of course you would be happy. But the truth is, I think what makes us the happiest is not the money, it's the achievement. And that's a different thing. To get in a novel that you really believe in and understand that it's a big deal and have an auction where there's a lot of action and people get in on it, that's something that you made happen. And the better deal you get for it, the prouder you are of that. And then at some point it occurs to you to sit down and count the money. Oh, look, I made money here. That's cool. But when you're in the middle of doing it, this really, you're not thinking about your own money. You're thinking about the quality of the deal that you are making and doing it in a way that is fair to everybody, and obviously in a way where you get the best deal. So there are strategies involved, and you have to keep your cool, and you have to have your ducks in a row and think about a lot of different things. Then when it's over, sometimes some of us here will experience a down. Like, oh, I could have done better. Oh, why didn't I think of that thing or, you know, whatever. And then about 2 weeks after that, you say, wait a minute, I did great here. That was good. That was good. And the author's happy. Everybody's happy. But, you know, this is our job, and we want to be proud of the work that we do. So it's not all sitting around, you know, the king was in his counting house counting out his money. That's not all that we do.
On the publisher's side, who's the person you deal with on the publisher's side?
Well, usually it's an editor. An editor buys the book. Sometimes we may go to the publisher directly if it's something very big or something that we know they might be personally interested in, but almost always it's an editor. Usually, yeah, I might want to format it a little more appropriately. Hopefully it won't need a lot of work. I don't actually like to do that much editorial. Nobody does. It's very time-consuming. If it's something I know exactly what to do to make it saleable, then I will do it. If it's just, well, it isn't very good and I'm not sure what to do, then I'm not going to bother.
So essentially, you want something to arrive to you as perfect as possible.
Of course.
And
yeah,
then
of course.
Something you don't have to say, okay, you never like suggest to people to change a point of view or anything like that?
Oh, that would be huge, changing a point of view. No, but as I said, if there's one thing that's easily fixable that I know will make it more saleable, then that's okay if it's easily done and if the author agrees to do it.
And then it goes to the editor, and nowadays...
Well, then I send it to more than one editor.
Hoping for an auction.
Well, we're hoping for a sale. But it only takes one to have a sale, and it only takes two to have an auction. So, you know, it's always nice when you have more than one offer. It's much easier. But we are professionals, and if we only get the one, we know how to work it. We know there are things we can do to improve it and make it as good as it can be. And eventually somebody either wins the auction or buys the book, and somebody buys it eventually. Or not. I mean, people have to realize that, too. There's always the one that got away. We don't sell 100% of what we send out. We would like that, but and there's no agent in the world who can boast that kind of track record. Then the editor buys it, and then it goes through the entire production process of the publisher, which means that the editor edits the book. They don't do near as much as they used to, but they do some. And then it goes to the copy editor, and it, you know, goes through the entire process. The cover has to be designed. If the agent has any is any good at all, the offer will have some kind of cover consultation or approval. And so that has to happen. A lot of emails back and forth with, you know, with various cover designs. And at some point, the publicity process has to start. It depends how far away the publication date is. But certainly, 6 months before you want to be thinking about it, and 3 months before you really have to be thinking about it. And again, it depends on how important the book is to them and how much they're going to do. And the author has to be very smart and very savvy about what they're going to do. There's a great deal they can and should do, but there are other things that are very expensive that I would not advise them to do. Because they'll just be spending a lot of money, and there's no guarantee that it's going to do anything.
Well, all in all, I think you have one of the most exciting jobs in the world. I mean, first, you just get to read books, and I love to read books before everybody else. This is one of the joys of having this program. I get books, you know, months in advance before everybody. I will have like a Margaret George book, you know, 6 months before anybody else, and I'm saying, I've read that book.
These are published books or about to be published.
About to be, yeah. But it's so exciting.
No, you don't know what it's like to have to read slush, unsolicited manuscripts that come in that need to be looked at. Usually it's a query letter. Each of us here gets approximately 10 a day, and that's more than we can handle. Which means we're always behind. We do try to look at it, but
well, I know you have. I've of course interviewed Barbara Powell and Miriam Chris, two of your agents. Fantastic!
Right.
And I as I've told you before, whenever you have a book and an author who wants to come on Joy on Paper, send them my way because I love to interview your clients. And people can go to your website. I want to mention before we leave that you do a charity auction. And it's just a wonderful opportunity for an author to get a real serious critique. And all the money goes to charity, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so where do they...
They should just look on our website on the home page. If you scroll down, there's a place you can click, and that will take you right to the auction page. And that's all you need to do. And you will get a personal critique written by me. I read every word, and I write every word of the critique coming from me.
Well, I can tell. I want to thank you, Irene Goodman, so much for being on Joy on Paper. You were my first guest, and I just want to thank you so much for everything you've done for me.
Well, you are very welcome, and it's always a pleasure to be on.
Okay. Thanks, Irene. Bye-bye now.
Okay. Bye, Patsy.
Wow, that's nice. Okay. Well, remember what I say. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're lucky, to have those magic words said, lights, camera, action, and your book is turned into a film or a streaming video or perhaps a television series like on Hallmark. For Carol J. Perry. Anyway, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. Wow, it's been an exciting 4 years. And again, thank you all. And my website is radio-joyonpaper. Go there and put in a question for Bill Larson. He'll be here next week. Bye-bye now.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com. From the author of gut-wrenching novels Guns Up and Gunner's Glory, now a gut-wrenching comedy, Section 8. One fan writes, Section 8 is inspired insanity. Johnny Clark should receive the Pulitzer Prize and his commitment papers in the same ceremony. You will laugh till it hurts. Section 8. It's 1946, and President Harry Truman has two goals in life. Dump the U.S. Marine Corps and get reelected. Can he convince Congress that the Marine Corps is obsolete? He'll try, but first he wants to use them one last time. There's something he needs them to do. A little mission to China to steal something that one of his contributors need. It's dangerous, but who cares? Marines are expendable, or so he thinks. What could possibly go wrong? A lawsuit by the Vatican? An attempted assassination by a dead assassin? Flamethrower sermons? If that's not enough, there's a missing A-bomb. This book has it all, even a love story. Remember, Section 8 is only a temporary state. You hope, written by a true American hero. You'll love this book, now available on Amazon. So get it today. Section 8 by Johnny Clark. Semper Fi.